15 for 12 years, 13 years at that point. So I was coming in as a financial sector expert. And I think the intent of that conference was to look at all the accomplishments of the Greenspan era. And my sense going into that was I talk about all the financial innovation that had happened and you know, the kinds of benefits they were having for the economy. But as I started looking at some of the developments, I got a little more concerned that that in fact there were risks building up that we may not have been paying enough attention to. Now, I want to say at the outset that there are always you know, people warning about disaster, and this is the problem that the regulators have, that there are people, you know, saying the world is going to end tomorrow, and they'll give you some reasons. And what you have to figure out is how likely that is, and whether you know, it's important enough, costly enough to try and undertake remedial measures. My sense is that what I was saying in terms of the developments were not news to the people at that forum. These were all central bankers, and clearly they understood the kind of innovation that had been taking place. They understood who was writing credit default swaps, for example, and they had a sense of what was going on. I think where we differed may have been on whether the financial sector had the right incentives to take care of things, or whether it was in fact taking too much risk and not and did not have the right private incentive to limit them. And my focus in that talk was more about the fact that the incentive structures were playing out in a way that the private sector didn't have incentives, enough incentives to take cognizance of the risk they were creating, and it was not just the shadow financial system, the non-bank system. Even the banks were now at the center of this, and one had to worry.
Yes. How many people were there?
Oh, a few hundred, 300, 400.
What kind of a room were you in? What kind of a location was it?
It's a big room. It takes place every year at Jackson Hole. It's a fairly big room.
Is it at a hotel?
It's the Jackson Lake Lodge.
Jackson Lake Lodge.
Yes, the Jackson Lake Lodge. The Kansas City Fed has been running this for many years. The nice thing about this is that it's a who's who of central bankers who show up, as well as many academic monetary economists. So you do get a lot of very, very important people in that area.
Is it people from around the world or just Americans?
Around the world. At that conference, we had, Alan Greenspan, Ben Bernanke. He was not yet selected at that point.
Well, I guess he was with the president, the Council of Economic Advisors. Then I think
he was. Yeah. He had moved to the council at that point. There was Jean-Claude Trichet. There was Mervyn King. A who's who.
Yes. So it's a quite an elite thing even to get an invitation.
Yes. You throw a sandwich, you hit a central banker of high repute.
So how many people make presentations at the conference?
There are about six. It differs every year, but five or six. And obviously, the highlight of the discussion is the opening speech by the chairman of the Federal Reserve.
Uh-huh.
And I think that conference has been known for important speeches. This year, for example, Ben Bernanke talked about having the tools to deal with deflation and emphasizing quantitative easing as a potential. And you can see the market reaction ever since that day.
Right. Really, really interesting. And now, at what point did you realize that you weren't getting an enthusiastic reaction?
I think that there was a sense that I was asking for more regulation, and I think the mood at that time in general was, the private sector can take care of itself. Yes, there are risks. Yes, we all understand there are risks. Yes, the housing market is a little frothy. But the private sector is not going to take undue risks. Moreover, we've been through episodes of stress before, in 1998 with the LTCM crisis, in 2001 with the dot-com bust. And we, the Fed, know how to take care of these. That, I think, was the sentiment. And there was a certain element also, I would think, of raining on Greenspan's parade. This was the wrong time to bring up these issues, uh-huh, when the general discussion was more about his contributions to humanity, which certainly at that time were being much praised. So in that sense, I think the timing of the speech, as well as the suggestion that that we may want to change, for example, the patterns of compensation and the incentive structures within the financial firms, was not well received. There was a sense that if it had to be done, the private sector would do it already. What is it that we're missing that they're not doing?
How many people spoke or raised or asked you questions?
They were about, I would say, six or seven. I think the discussant was Don Cohn from the Federal Reserve Board.
So he was like moderator?
He was not the vice chairman. No, he was a discussant.
Okay.
I don't remember who the who the chairman of the session was. He was the discussant, and I think he made the point that that in general, the Fed had been through episodes of stress before, and knew how to deal with them.
Right.
And my sense is that I think we collectively underestimated the effect of problems with credit. We had been through a stock market bubble. We had been through an emerging market sort of disaster, but we'd never been through a problem in the United States which centered around credit. And I think that made all the difference. I had hinted in the paper that could make a difference, but I didn't spend a huge amount of time on it, and I think that point, in a sense, was lost.
And then one of the people that spoke was the president of Harvard.
Yes, I mean, I think Larry Summers misunderstood to some extent what I was trying to say. Not entirely. I mean, I think his sense was I was advocating a move back to the times when banking was boring. So he called me a Luddite, which in the transcript of the conference got read as Leddite.
I know, I've seen that. That's so funny.
Yeah,
whoever did that had never heard of the phrase before.
Yeah. No, so what he really meant was Luddite. And I think the... actually, there was a comment from Mervyn King which got excised later on. I think Mervyn didn't want it published. I think now for good reason.
What did he say?
But their fear, and I'm not entirely unsympathetic to it, was that at that point, both the United States and the United Kingdom saw the financial sector as being important sources of well-being for the country, and were reluctant to see substantial constraints put on them. And I think that motivated the kind of response. I mean, the Europeans, who historically have been much more willing to regulate and have a stronger belief in regulation, were in fact more open to what I was saying. Jean-Claude Trichet thought it was, I mean, came to me later and was very complimentary. So I think it played into different views of regulation, different views on the importance of the financial sector, and as a result, I think there was more hostility. I wouldn't say it was in any way uniform, and there were people in the audience, Alan Blinder, I think, and Stan Fisher, who defended some of the propositions I was putting forward. So, but I would say that there was more of a sense that this was off base, and you know, I mean, it's not just the regulators. There was very little mention of it in the financial press, which usually comments on the papers that were presented, except for The Economist. The Economist talked about it, but you know, some of the other financial press, The Wall Street Journal, The Financial Times, just gave it a pass, even though my guess is that particular session was quite controversial.
How interesting. What did Mervyn King say?
You know, I would be misquoting given the distance from then. I do remember that he was suggesting that a certain amount of tolerance for the financial sector was warranted. I remember the analogy went into, you know, where are your children at this point? And should we be keeping a close eye on them all the time? We talked about children. But I would be misquoting
this. Was this like some variation of this nanny state concept?
Yes. I mean, there was a sense that you can become overly protective and thereby, reduce national output and so on. It was interesting that it was the countries with the biggest financial sectors that worried about it, but clearly they're the ones that would worry about it the most. But of course, now we worry about it in a different direction. The UK is dead scared that its financial sector is too big and will take it down with it.
Right. Why do you think that I've read your book, and you're obviously a very knowledgeable person. It was an excellent book, I thought, too. You're very well informed, but I have kind of an interesting question in that there was so many people just thinking all along the same lines during that period in the face of a set of facts that were really quite extraordinary. Why do you think that people in the United States were so unable to see that there were a lot of questions rising? I wonder if your international experience made you more open to sort of seeing patterns in other countries and how they could play out in the United States as well.
That's a very good question. And first, thanks for the kind remarks in the book. I don't know. I would say even now, I have a really hard time in some quarters trying to argue that there are deeper structural problems in the United States that the United States has to focus on solving, that these are issues that it's not just cyclical. We're not just in a downturn like every other one. We should take this as a message that there are deeper problems that we need to also tackle. I think that there certainly was a sense, even within academia, and I should accept full responsibility as an academic, that the United States was the high point of economic development, and that we had in many ways taken care of all the problems that other countries had. And even if some industrial countries like Japan had deep financial problems, it was something that happened in other countries, could not happen back here, because after all, we had good regulators, we had really smart people running these banks. It was, you know, the notion that, you know, Japan, there's something else different, there's something cultural that explain why they got into that slump for so long. Of course, now people are making comparisons between the slump here and slump in Japan. I think those comparisons are overblown, but nevertheless, we've come a long way from saying this happens elsewhere, this happens to other people, it doesn't happen in this sophisticated country. And I think in part many of us, and I have to admit to being part of the crowd, thought that U.S. institutions were strong and would somehow take care of it. Yes, we saw aberrations, but the aberrations were individual, and we thought somehow the institutions would overcome it. I have an analogy, if you don't mind, I can give you, uh-huh. which is, you know, before 9/11, uh-huh. right? Before 9/11, I saw the sloppiness of security sometimes at the airports. I traveled quite a bit. But I always thought that, you know, somehow the U.S. had figured it out. Somehow behind those mirrors that you walk past, there were agents, you know, looking at every passenger and saying, is this guy a potential threat? Is that guy? And that's why the U.S. didn't have any hijackings for the last, you know, 10, 12 years, right? I thought somehow there was a system. And of course, when the 9/11 hijackers got on board with their box cutters, we realized there wasn't much of a system in place at that point, right?
Yes, right.
Unfortunately, but we realized that somehow the institutions we thought were there didn't actually exist. And I think we sort of got into a little bit of that, and danger with that, when you think the institutions are there and you start relying on them, is that you lose some of the other skills. The kind of forensic accounting of bank balance sheets that would take place in some of the emerging markets, because you simply don't trust the banks. And therefore, you'd go out and see exactly what they have and try and figure out how big they are, their exposures are. My sense is we stopped doing that to a large extent. Of course, we did a little more of that once we saw Enron in 2001, but probably not enough. And so to that extent, I don't think the market fully understood the size of the exposures and so on. And part of it is that we may have increased our reliance more than warranted.
That's an interesting point. I think it's one of the things that is quite interesting is that when, you know, we've conducted a great many interviews, it's noticeable how few firms actually sent people out to do on the street due diligence. And one of the few that did was PIMCO. And, you know, they, as soon as everybody got back after looking at 20 cities, they said, we've got to get the heck out of the private label securities business. And so, you know, there was just not a lot of old-fashioned fact-checking going on.
Right.
And that's, right. It sounds like that's something that you had noticed.
No, I mean, if you think about it, I mean, once everybody starts relying on the institutional structures, on the reporting, the whitewash reporting that people put out, then in a sense there's even more incentive to deviate and do the wrong thing, right? Because people aren't paying attention to the details. That's sort of the dilemma of development, in a sense, that as the institutions start working, there's a very big question about who monitors the institutions. And my sense is that we didn't pay enough attention to that question.
Fascinating. Thank you.
Let me ask you something. You were on record raising alarms. You mentioned in your book some others who had raised alarms as well. But and many other people with whom we've spoken have raised the same issue. With your understanding of the history of finance, history of economics, has there ever been a situation, and it's just occurred to me now, where somebody raised an alarm and people actually paid attention, as opposed to saying, gee, we have a Luddite in our midst. There's that criticism of accountants that they predicted, 12 of the last 6 recessions or something like that. Does anybody ever pay attention to the Cassandras of the world and do in time to do something about it?
Well, so there might be a logical. I shouldn't say logical. There might be a problem with the question that way, because in a sense, if they did something about it, we wouldn't have the crash to complain about, right? In a sense, you're asking the question: how many big downturns have been averted because people raised questions and then the companies adjusted, and we never saw the downturn after that. That's a hard question to answer, because if in fact they had paid attention, it would have been a non-event after that, right? I mean, put differently, are there situations of innovations that were nipped in the bud, or accounting shenanigans that were found early? You basically stopped it when it was small. It didn't get big, and as a result, it didn't make the news after that. And my sense is there must have been some, but we'll never know. What we do know about is, of course, the big crashes before which people either made silly statements or the famous Fisher statement. Fisher was a big economist before the Great Depression, who said, stocks have reached a new higher plateau in 1929, after which, of course, we know what happened. But also that, Guy Cassandras can only be identified with respect to a crash that actually happened. The many warnings that actually get listened to, we don't see. But that's sort of a quick and dirty answer. I think the real problem, which I think you're getting at, is that there are big risks in the midst of a boom to listening too closely to any warning, because you have to do something, and typically what that means is in a sense deflating some of the boom that is taking place, if you're serious enough about it. And there are huge incentives to keep that going. I mean, the easiest example of this is Chevron Greenspan's speech on irrational exuberance. I think delivered in 1996, it certainly, in hindsight, everybody says it was overreach. It shouldn't have been made, because after all, the stock market went up till 1999. But of course, I think the flip side of that is if in fact the Fed had taken actions following that warning that he gave, maybe we wouldn't have had the sequence of booms and busts that we've had since, and maybe would have had a calmer ride. We will never know, But I think the point to take away from that is even when the chairman of the Fed is worried and tries to give a warning, the forces that support the boom tend to be quite strong. I mean, who wants to see their stock portfolio fall by 20%? And so you have to have a huge amount of confidence that you're right in order to go attack the boom. And I don't think that degree of confidence exists amongst anybody. Because you're always hopeful that that somehow things will work out. And I should have said this earlier. I mean, it seems to me that there wasn't any big conspiracy in that room in Jackson Hole. I think people were just saying that, look, the costs of killing this boom are going to be really high. We need to have far more confidence that something is really going wrong. And if we can believe that the private sector is sort of taking care of itself, well, that's a comfortable belief, and then we don't really need to do much.
You're pretty critical of regulations and the regulatory process. At least it seemed that way when I read your book. Is that an outgrowth? Do you think that was an outgrowth of just the way the world evolved from the early 1980s, or do you think there were political influences, or how do you think the regulatory system evolved to where things got as loose as they appeared to have become?
Well, I am not in the camp which says an unregulated world is the best of worlds. I think we need regulations. But we need to be sensible about what can be enforced, as well as the incentives and pressures on the enforcer. And I think that there were plenty of regulations that were there in place that could have limited what happened. But I think the regulators, in part, were taken in with the mood of the moment, but in part were also sort of cognizant of the pressures that would fall on them if they did anything differently. And so I think when we say the problem is we have too little regulation, I think that's just part of the problem, not always the important problem. The important problem is how do you make sure that the regulations are enforced by an independent and impartial regulator, and that second piece I think is often missing. I would say that even now, when we are heaping regulation upon new regulation on the system, the jury is still out on how these things will be enforced down the line. And, you can have all the regulations in the world at your fingertips, but if you don't have the right incentives or the pressures are for you to go light, you have enough leeway to do that. So my push, if you will, has been in two ways. One, let's have regulations that cover the entire system, rather than work heavily on one part of it while leaving other parts lightly or totally unregulated, because then the natural impulse will be for activity to move from the heavily regulated part to the lightly regulated part. That has to be one of the lessons we learned from this particular episode. The second I would emphasize is we need to have a sense that there are other watchdogs looking at the regulator and that have the information to act if the regulator is not doing his job. And I'm not talking about congressional committees, I'm talking about even the private sector. That, to my mind, one of the biggest innovations in Dodd-Frank, I think, is this Office of Financial Research. If that office can do its job and give the public, especially the knowledgeable public, a sense of the exposures that are building up in the system, and is allowed to access deeper data and can share that data, modulo, concerns about privacy, can share that data widely, we will have another level of monitoring of the system itself. So I think we need to ask the question, who monitors the regulators themselves, who ensures that the regulators, in the words of William Chesney Martin, don't drink the punch bowl while the party is going, so they have no capacity to take it away. So I would emphasize those aspects as we go forward.
So if we had had such an office, this is Greg Felberg, what vulnerabilities in the system do you think that they should have seen, or what questions should they have asked that maybe regulators were not asking around 2005?
If we had this Office of Financial Research?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would say, one, the significant buildup of exposures in across bank portfolios in the United States to the real estate sector would have been one flag. The quality of the extent of exposure to the subprime mortgage backed securities would have been another. The choke points that many of the guarantees, for example, to the muni bond market were flowing through a few small mortgage insurance agencies. That could have been another. Essentially, if you had drawn heat maps, so to speak, at that time of where the flows were, where they were going through, and what kinds of exposures were building up, both to sectors as well as to products, I think we would have been a little more worried. I do remember asking a Fed official that I will keep nameless in about 2007. This was right before the mortgage guarantee agencies, MBIA, and people like that blew up. I remember asking this person, are you worried? I hear from my friends on the street that these guys are grossly undercapitalized for what they've insured. And his response was, no, they're AAA. And in hindsight, I mean, that seems like such a excessively confident reply, basing essentially the answer on another set of agencies, the rating agencies, to have done their jobs on these guys. But it does reflect to some extent that the system itself didn't know the exposures, the regulators in the system didn't know the exposures and weren't paying enough attention to their build-up.
So we've been looking at this as two crises, as a housing crisis and a financial crisis, and then kind of looking at the way the two are interrelated. Do you agree with it, with looking at it that way, and how would you describe kind of the financial crisis as it played itself out over 2008?
Yeah, I think you're right that it starts with the housing crisis, and then that becomes the source of the bad loans, so to speak, and the bad assets that then people don't know where they are and how much and how contained they are, and then the effects spread into a full blown financial panic, which is 2008. I think that sequence is certainly the right one.
This is Landon Strobel. I was hoping you could talk a little about, in some of your prior writings, you mentioned some situations in which the traditional banking system acted as a liquidity backstop to the newer shadow banking system, and specifically like with LTCM. But you were careful to specify that under certain conditions, that relationship may not hold. For example, if there are particular credit risks in the commercial banking system, and especially credit risks that are hard to identify and may be hidden in some ways. I was curious if you could tell us a little about how that compares with how you feel the financial crisis carried out in 2007.
Yeah, I mean, I think that typically we think that that banks are certainly commercial banks are asset are balance sheet managers and use their balance sheet to take on certain risks, but also I think because they can. They can take in liquidity, give out liquidity, are at the center of liquidity flows to some extent. My sense of what was happening, post Lehman, is that there were suddenly questions being raised about any entity. So we know for sure that the commercial paper market, certainly the asset-backed commercial paper market, dried up. So a whole bunch of entities that were dependent on that stopped being able to finance that. And you would assume that the flows that were going into the commercial paper market would then go back into the banks, and then the banks could re-intermediate those back to financing the asset-backed commercial paper. And my sense is that this time around, it didn't work as neatly and effectively, and I haven't seen this documented in any detail, so this is at this point conjecture, but I'm guessing that that at that point some of that money didn't flow back into the banking sector, so the banks themselves, at least for a while, found themselves short of funds while they had the need to finance some of these assets which were getting financed in the asset-backed commercial paper market, and so with many banks, certainly the investment banks, the big investment banks, but also to some extent the commercial banks being suspect that they themselves had problems. I think the flow, the inflow of deposits, didn't take place as effectively and as quickly as it did in the LTCM crisis, and so essentially the government had to come in at that point to keep the system afloat with a mix of guarantees and so on. So I think the fact that the institutions at the center of the system became suspect was key to the panic and the crisis. And of course, why they became suspect in part is because there were big problems in housing, which then filtered into housing securities and so on.
When you think about some of the fragilities that became apparent, certainly in hindsight, were there any that surprised you in particular with respect to shadow banking markets?
Yes, I mean, I can't say that I was I knew about the size of assets that were being held off balance sheet in these SIVs and conduits. And I was just surprised that there was so much of this stuff. We all knew about hedge funds. We knew about, to some extent, hedge funds did what they were supposed to. A bunch of them failed, but by and large, they didn't pose huge systemic risks. Though I would say that they must have, contributed to some of the trading and the bets against the financial firms. But that's part of what they're supposed to do. The what was totally surprising was, I would say, one, these conduits and SIVs, and two, the extent of guarantees written by entities with very limited capitalization. I would certainly talk about the credit default swaps written by AIG, but also about the mortgage guarantees written by entities like MBIA.
So what have we learned about the costs and benefits of innovations? And what could we have done to have tested or to try to have figured out what was going on with CDOs and credit default swaps? And what kind of rules should we have thought about?
I'm sorry, it's about innovation, the costs and benefits of innovation?
Yeah.
Okay. I would suggest that there's a lot of financial innovation which requires actual trial to understand how it works and to make sure that you've got it right and so on. So a system by which every innovation has to go through a lengthy approval process, I think, could be problematic. I think that in many situations you may curb innovation too much, and you may also not know what problems will arise when it is actually implemented. So in general, I mean, other than saying yes, you have to be careful that your customers know what they're getting into, that there should be full disclosure, that there are customers who are appropriate for some of these things that you're doing. I would say that a certain amount of experimentation with new stuff is fine. I think the problems arise when you let certain products get really big without having stress tested them in a real downturn, in a real problem situation, and that's where the difficulties of policy come in. I mean, it would be nice to keep that product relatively small till you've been through a cycle, but of course a cycle will not throw up systemic problems if in fact you've kept it relatively small. I would say the onus on the regulator become significantly higher once the product attains any size, and if you are willing to allow it to expand, you better have modeled it in many ways and ensured that under a variety of stressful scenarios, the product will work as advertised. And you're also sure of what exposure means, et cetera, et cetera. Put differently, I would prefer a scale where small innovations are allowed, provided they're decent, honest products. I shouldn't say decent, they're honest products. But once you get beyond a certain size, the weight on the regulator to investigate them, to make sure that they're what they are, and to monitor the exposures across the system to that product should increase disproportionately.
Yeah, a tough order in given the nature of the system, which leads me actually to ask another question about systems. Is this something that's just inevitable given the nature of the incentives that people operate under in a system like this, or is this something which you think could and should be prevented with better foresight, better rules, or better enforcement of existing rules? We've heard a lot of a lot on that.
Yeah.
from both points of view.
See, I think nothing is fail-safe, right? So I would put it as a three or four layer set of measures that you have at your command. The first is to make sure that the incentive structures are as good as you can make them. And nobody willingly goes out there to lose money. Nobody willingly goes there to take risks that would tank their firm if they know that's going to happen for sure. The problem is when the bet is skewed, when there is, as you well know, you know, more benefit from taking the risk and more ability to socialize the losses, share them with others who don't really haven't contracted to share them. So finding ways first to get the incentives more aligned, I think, has to be the first path of attack. And some of this will require ensuring the risk is priced through the system. And this is where I think a lot of the attention, a lot of the focus has been on incentive structures for managers within firms, on appropriate incentives for the board. But I think you could in some ways argue that they were all doing what came naturally to them, that ultimately when there is somebody backs, you know, acting as the backstop, either implicitly or explicitly, they do have the incentive to take on too much risk. So if we want the taxpayer to stop acting as a backstop, I think we should make far better use of some of the instruments that these firms issue to serve as the first line of defense. And in particular, I would say debt. We have to make sure once we get back to normal times that we have systems by which debt will automatically get impaired when the firm gets into trouble. That way, debt can serve as a kind of what's the word? Canary
in
the gold mine. You debt spreads will widen as the firm takes more risk, but also there is some burden sharing that will take place. You can't rely on equity because equity gets so much of the upside, but debt, to my mind, is where you have to have more of the action. Now, of course, if this debt is held by other levered institutions, then you're back to square one because you've got to bail out the debt, otherwise you get contagion. So some effort on making sure that the debt is available and is held by entities who can absorb the loss but who can also act knowing that the debt issuer is taking more risk. I mean, that, I think, has to be important. So getting incentives right. A sort of corollary is getting prices right. I think if you have people who can take on a lot of risk but then can still sell their claims with impunity into the market and the market doesn't back up, then, you know, in the arm's length system that we have, we can go really far off track. So I think ensuring that prices aren't distorted through either implicit or explicit, you know, government guarantees or money coming in from outside. I mean, those are the kinds of things that we have to be careful about. But, you know, we'll never do a perfect job at incentives, and this goes back to your earlier question. Does the system sort of, is it trying desperately to make a buck, and does it sort of go overboard? And every once in a while, you will have that happen. So I think the second line of defense has to be buffers. You need to increase capital in the system, but in such a way that you don't increase it only in part of the system and see all the activity migrate elsewhere. You have to have the entire system reasonably capitalized, and it has to be across the board. So clever ways of bringing in capital at the right time, I think, are also useful. And then that leads to the third point. Even if you have capital to buffer when things go really badly, every once in a while, you will find that firms eat through that buffer. And this is where, you know, you have to let people know that in the ultimate analysis, every institution that does really badly will be allowed to fail. And so resolution, making resolution effective is I think the third element of this. And the final element is that when you lose these institutions, you should have ready ways to replace them. So having redundancy in the system so that no entity is central and key and has to be kept alive, I think is extremely important. So multiple players doing the same thing, making sure that all flows don't go through one choke point, all these things I think will be critical. Now, even after you do all this, have we eliminated the problem of a meltdown? No, but hopefully we've reduced it reduce the probabilities considerably.
Do you think the United States economy is going to fully recover?
Of course. you know, why am I so confident? I mean, I do think there's a fundamental core of innovative strength, flexibility of talent in this economy, which will bring it back. I do think, and I keep emphasizing this, that there are problems that we need to tackle sooner rather than later. In many ways, my most serious concern is that countries that have poor governance, countries that we used to term banana republics in the past, are there not because people are stupid, they don't understand what they need to do, but because the private interests of people differ so much that they can never come to agreement, and that's why you get really terrible policies. So my firm belief is that when you have a country where intrinsic inequality is strongly embedded, then people see things very differently. The culture, the political climate gets extremely polarized, and it becomes impossible to get the willingness to do what everybody understands must be done. And I worry that I don't think we're still quite there, though you might think that looking at what's happening in Washington, which I'm sure you guys have a much closer view of, but I think we could get there if we don't do the right things. And one of the things that certainly in my writing I've tried to emphasize is one of the virtues of the United States was broad access to opportunity via everybody having access to good education, to decent jobs, job opportunities, and to decent finance. And my sense is some of that is not true anymore, certainly on the education part and to some extent on healthcare. And we need to find out how to make it such that that we can bring back that access.
Well, it's almost time for us to end. Is there anything that we haven't asked you about that we should have, or that you'd like to just talk to us about while you
Well, I would let me quickly add one of the things that emerges in my view from this crisis is that it's not about the private sector or about the public sector. It's really about the interface between the two. If we get the interface between the private sector and the regulator, the private sector and the public sector wrong, then we can go a long distance off track. For example, if the guarantees the public sector offers the private sector are large and extreme, the private sector can undertake actions which are completely, which are really hard to understand in a market economy. So we need to think about how we manage those interfaces. One example, for example, is housing and housing credit. How much of a role is the public sector going to play going forward there? Does it really have to play as much of a role? Can a sophisticated economy like the United States have a housing sector where the government is not responsible for providing the finance, but the private sector does so and takes its lumps when it goes overboard? I think the history of government guarantees, whether it's deposit insurance or the guarantees to Fannie and Freddie, is that they're always, almost always, underpriced, and as a result create eventual distortions in the system. And so I would think that as we emerge from this crisis, just investigating the ways in which the government guarantees the private sector and trying to back off as much as possible from those guarantees, and some may be impossible to back off, but trying to reduce that has to be one of the elements, of course, in addition to all the regulation and so on that we've talked about.
I guess I just have one last question about causes of the financial crisis. If you could suppose that in 2005 and 2006, some of the problems with origination of subprime mortgages could have been mitigated, and as a consequence, a lot of the very poor assets in 2006 and 2007 were not originated. Could you still see a financial crisis of similar magnitude resulting from problems in other asset classes, let's say commercial real estate or leveraged loans?
It's a very good question, and I think that the in part you're asking, did this have to be in that sector? Wasn't eventually there a general sense of euphoria, a general sense that risks didn't matter, and I think. I think there is some of that that's going on. I think that banks had been rewarded for taking various forms of tail risk throughout the 1990s, and subprime mortgage-backed securities just happened to be one form of the tail risk they were happy to take on, but they were taking it in other forms also, as in the leveraged loans and elsewhere. And so it might have been only a matter of time before another tail risk that they'd loaded up on came proper and brought the system down. In particular, I think one tail risk which the sequence of events highlighted was that they had all bet that liquidity would be plentiful, and were not prepared for a day that liquidity dried up. And, you know, that's a more historical source of problems for banks, that, in the euphoria, you think financing is easy, financing is plentiful, you take on these long-term illiquid bets, and you finance yourself through short-term easily available financing until the day that financing dries up. So I think the answer to your question is, it probably could have got into trouble in a different way. May have taken a few more years, but you can't rule that out.
Raghu, this is Stephen Mintz. I have one final question I think might help wrap it up. Do you think, in view of the underreaction leading up to the financial crisis, there's any danger of an overreaction going forward to alarms of any kind?
Yes, I think that at this point, having been seared by the crisis, there is of course a danger we get overly cautious, and we attack anything that looks like excess quickly, but. I would also argue that some of the political forces that were pushing in the direction of easier credit, more monetary stimulus, are still with us. And so we're paying, in some ways, we are paying less attention, given how bad a crisis we've been through, to the quality of the kind of investments that different entities are making. I mean, every day you read in the paper about pension funds saying there's no percentage in investing in short-term government securities. They pay nothing, so they're stretching out, investing more in high-yield securities, in long-term assets. Of course, anytime you do that, you're taking on more credit risk, more duration risk, and that will eventually come to haunt them if interest rates start backing up in a serious way. At one level, I'm sympathetic to what you're saying, that individual banks, having been seared, are being much more careful. Risk management is much better. I've heard talk that the regulators are now much more careful about about inspections and trying to make sure that banks have fessed up to all their problems. All that is for the good, and there may be a certain sense in which it's going overboard, but I also think that we haven't fully taken on board some of what happened, and there are areas where problems are building up.
Thanks.
Okay, well,
So I guess your summary then, if listening to this, would be that the intersection of private and public didn't work out quite the way it should have this time, and maybe we'll do better.
We hope.
We hope. Well, thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
Thanks a lot again.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Have a happy Thanksgiving. Where is he?